Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere.
Basically, Betsy DeVos is dismantling the entire civil rights commitment in the education department that has been there since Lyndon Johnson. So she's in the midst of dismantling all that. And the second
thing—
What does
that mean?
What it means is that if I am a kid in Texas, and I think that something has happened to me that, you know, has been terrible, that I'm not getting a decent education, and somebody right next door who happens to be of a different color is, I used to be able to go to the education department and say, wait a second, something's wrong here.
Today's guest, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, the main teachers union, and one of the more prominent labor leaders in the country. I've known Weingarten since she was the head of the United Federation of Teachers, her union's New York chapter, and I was covering politics in New York. She was a big part of the debates over charter schools and teacher tenure, Mike Bloomberg's takeover of authority for the city school system from the way it had been to that point, and is in most other places, with the state government in charge. How big of a political force was she? Well, when Hillary Clinton left her Senate seat to be Secretary of State in 2009, Weingarten was given serious consideration, in some tellings, was one of the finalists, for the appointment which ultimately went to Kirsten Gillibrand. That didn't work out for her, but not long after, she moved to Washington and took over the National Union in an office that has a straight-shot view of the Capitol Dome right up New Jersey Avenue, which is where we sat down. She started off by showing me a big blown-up paragraph she'd written, which she said she'd come up with on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend this year, but first reminded me that, of course, she'd been a social studies teacher for 6 years herself. Here's the quote. The 2018 elections have taken on an urgency I have never experienced in my lifetime. It is not simply a fight for fairness or justice or policies we champion for working folks and their families. We must be a check and balance for our democracy and for a society that is safe, welcoming, and sane. We must fight the anti-democratic, nativist, racist, incompetent, oligarchical, authoritarian, and cruel instincts and actions of this president and his cronies and associates that simply want an intolerant, divisive, Gilded Age society. It is a which side are you on moment. I pointed out to her a lot of that is outside of the purview of unions, but not to her. To her, it's a simple proposition. It's a problem for her, given the Trump administration's approach to organized labor and the long-expected Janus decision from the Supreme Court that came down in June, which made it so unions couldn't force non-members to pay dues to support collective bargaining. That's basically the union making an overall deal about salaries and benefits with the government. Janus was a major blow to unions, and one that President Trump and his supporters were very happy about, not just because it changes the kinds of agreements that can get made, but because it also eliminates a lot of the money that they felt was going in to subsidize political activity from the unions. And of course, they felt that was going for Democrats. Weingarten hated the decision, but insisted that there's a silver lining, and the way you'll hear her spell it out, I think it parallels what I've heard from a number of other union officials and other Democrats on a variety of topics. Essentially, Trump's presidency is a clarifying moment. Figuring out what's true here and what's spin is why I wanted to talk with her, especially as we head into this first election cycle post-Janus, but with already some elements of the story that make it a not necessarily simple narrative, like Missouri, a state where Republicans are hoping for one of their main Senate pickups this year against Claire McCaskill, that is under heavy Republican control, but in August voted by referendum to take down the right-to-work law that had been passed by the state legislature and signed by the now former governor. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or however you're listening. We're lining up the fall schedule now for those last couple of weeks until the midterms, so let me know who you'd like to hear. Email me with that and your other thoughts at isaacpolitico.com and follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. And now, my conversation with Randy Weingarten. So you're about to go on your honeymoon? You got married a long time
off
ago.
Off the record or on the record?
Well, I was going to do it on the record.
We're about to actually finally take our, you know, take a little break.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't. We're going to Israel because Sharon is a rabbi and she has a congregational trip. And I have a bunch of work, including the Israeli Teachers Union, that I could go see and things like that. So I would say we are actually getting off the transom for a couple of weeks, which I am very, very delighted for.
Is that just required when you marry a rabbi that you take a trip to Israel?
Well, I think that it's kind of, no, I think what's required is that you're in synagogue every Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's required. It's always great to go there, but it's always going there with a sense of purpose these days, not just, oh, I get to go to the Western Wall, or I get to see the beautiful olive trees, or, you know, the beautiful brick in Jerusalem, or the fantastic, you know, Mediterranean in Tel Aviv. It's really now a matter of, just like in the United States, how do you create a pathway to a better life that is about pluralism and about confronting division and bigotry and hate, and not letting the fear of the other overcome us. And so I see a lot of similarities now between the way in which we fight in America and the way in which progressive Jews or progressives have to fight in Israel.
Do you see that happening with other people who, that seems to be a realization that you've had? Do you find other American progressives have thought about things that way?
Well, it's really interesting that you ask that question that way, because, so for example, J Street asked me to do a keynote at their conference this year. And a lot of people are like, why is Randy Weingarten doing a keynote here? Okay, she's Jewish. Okay, she's married to a rabbi. Okay, that could be a joke. But the point is, what I just said to you, I said there in a speech, I got a huge response. And the people I got the best response from are students, millennials on college campuses. And the difference between J Street,
who are not usually the people who are responding so much to the AFT's messaging.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, people would not ordinarily think are responding to unions. That's changing as well. But what was surprising was that here's this American labor leader. So look, 30 years ago, an American labor leader who was Jewish was not an isolated instance. Mm-hmm. Now, an American labor leader who happens to be Jewish and married to a rabbi is pretty, it's not the norm.
Right, it's not the norm.
And so the fact that kids on college campuses who embrace a Jewish identity and are trying to think about how they think about Israel, that connection was real. Mm-hmm. Because what they're seeing is that it's the fight between their extremes, which in some ways, again, is what's happening here as well. It's not a fight between the left and the right. It is a fight for how do you help people get a better life. That is what the American dream has been about, and that is what the trade union movement is about. That is what public education is about. That is what voting is about. But when you get into the conversation between the extremes, then you have real challenges. What's interesting to me is that it's kind of consistent that same advocacy I do in America and in Israel.
The commute that you're making more often is between New York and Washington.
Yes.
I was thinking that I think the first time we sat down was 2007 in your office at the UFT.
In the UFT.
Which was smaller and very cluttered, as I remember it.
Yes. Still a lot of books.
This is a bigger office.
With a great view of the Capitol.
I remember your desk not having a lot of space to put a tape recorder down.
I still love paper.
Yeah. Well, it's good. Paper is good.
You know?
Even as a digital journalist, I'll tell you, paper is good. What is the experience of coming through New York politics do when you're thinking about what's going on now and your role now? The reason I ask it is I used to think like, okay, well, it's a good proving ground as a journalist, but in New York, it's all basically Democratic politics, right? And your fights were with Mike Bloomberg, who was elected as a Republican, but was basically a Democrat and had been a Democrat, now is an independent, now backing Democrats. Does it leave you connected to what the fights that are happening in Washington?
So that's a really great question. There was a big learning curve between being steeped in New York as UFT president and the first year that I was AFT president. And there was a learning curve. I'm still learning, but there was a huge learning curve because places like New York, California, where there's much more of a shared value over a bunch of different things, including that there's a real role for government and that government should be tending to people's needs, and people include a diverse group of people. And there was a shared value about immigrants that most of us were immigrants. Yes, of course, we need security, border security, things like that. But for example, after 9/11, it wasn't just President Bush who said, we're not going to tolerate discrimination against Muslims. It was the whole city coming together. Mm-hmm. I remember doing a press conference with Chris Quinn, with others, who was a city council speaker at that point. I don't remember.
Not in September 11, she wasn't, but she was coming up.
She was coming up at that point. But there were, even Rudy Giuliani at that point, there was a line that people were crossing when they were trying to blame an entire religion for this horrible terrorist act. And that's a different way of looking at life and pluralism and tolerance and opportunity and justice than I saw around the country. Around the country, there is a real fear of the other. And what I saw after 2016 in particular is I spent a lot of time in 2017 being in red states. And this is what I've learned. I started that learning process in 08, but this is what I've learned after 10 years of being in this job. Values really matter, and values can actually pierce through stereotypes and mischaracterizations.
What does that mean?
And so, and you know something? I think even Donald Trump understands that on the other side, because of the way in which he tries to undermine the media and undermine truth and make Trumpism the truth for his base.
So what does values really matter mean?
What it means to me is that there's a set of values that we as public educators and as the labor movement push forward. And they are connected with people having a pathway to a better life. So there's five of them that we that have become the AFT's mantra and medal. Economic dignity, public education, healthcare, so you're not one illness away from bankruptcy, the fight for an inclusive democracy that works for the people and by the people, and the fight against bigotry and hate. And so when we talk about those things, take economic dignity. A voice at work is absolutely essential. Having wages so that a family can prosper and do better than the last generation. Having retirement security. On education, it's not just K-12 public education, of which 25 states spend less today than they did in after the 2008 recession on public education. But it's also the fact that students are saddled with debt that's now making it harder for their parents to retire. There's been a new stat that just came out that said that bankruptcies are up for seniors. And one of the reasons is because they are saddled with their children's debt.
Co-signed on the loans.
But when I have found that when you focus on economic dignity, public education that is available for everyone, including higher education without saddling kids with unsustainable debt. Healthcare so that you're not one illness away from bankruptcy. This fight for democracy and the fight against bigotry and hate, those are values that are as strongly held in Van Wert, Ohio, which voted for Trump by like 70%, as they are in New York City, as they are in Silver Springs, Maryland, and Western Pennsylvania.
But people haven't been finding them within the Democratic Party.
I think what's happened is that people don't talk to each other. So the second piece that I learned, first piece is values. Second piece is connection, engagement. If people don't talk to each other, if all you get is your news, your information, your worldview from either watching your favorite TV or cable station or reading your Twitter feed or your Facebook news feed, what's happening is that you're basically in your own tribe.
Yeah.
And so engagement pierces this. And frankly, the labor movement used to be one of the most important ways of piercing it. So was public education. But in the last 20 years, that's become tribalized too. So
how did the labor movement fall down on that?
Well, I think if you look at what's happened, there has been a huge assault against workers being in unions. And we spent a lot of time fighting that assault.
And
not doing the other work because it's hard to do the other work when you're fighting that assault. I think what's happened is that in the post-Janus world and in the months that actually led up to Janus, and what just happened in Missouri this week is a huge indication of this, that there's a turning point now. We started seeing that turning point in polling.
Do you think so? That's just one result in Missouri.
Well, what I'm seeing as well.
I mean, then the Janus decision was a huge decision.
Yeah, but the Janus decision was 41 down 41 years of precedent for no apparent reason other than the conservatives on the court had the votes. They gave no compelling reason for turning around after approving this precedent for six or eight times. That's all kind of gobbledygook, you know, judicial speak for essentially saying the court ignored the scores of amicus brief from state legislators, from governors, from states around the country that said under the 10th Amendment, we get to make decisions about how we do labor relations with our employees. And 20 some odd states had said, we want to actually have the unions as if members want it, if people want it, as exclusive bargaining representatives. And the Supreme Court said, no, don't want to do that. This, what just happened in Missouri, who passed the same thing for the private sector, basically is the first result since Janus to say, no, the public doesn't want that. And let me just say something, one more thing, which is that is consistent with what we're seeing in the aftermath of Janus, that our members are sticking with the union. And we're seeing
it's not only been a couple of weeks, really. I mean, it was the end of June when that decision came down. So,
right.
I mean, you wouldn't have mass fleeing.
Well,
yet,
what
right?
we saw is, frankly, we saw a mass push, fuselage, I would say, by the right wing as soon as that decision was out, basically scamming every single school teacher in 10 states on their school email telling them to drop the union. And we have seen the right wing, you know this as well as I do, they've been preparing for this for several months now, and they spent a whole bunch of money in order to try to get people to drop. And what we've seen is that hasn't happened.
Oh, the president tweeted when the decision came, a big loss for the coffers of Democrats. He was very excited about the decision.
So think about the effect of that argument. Janus was supposedly from their view, about the individual rights of individual employees. But what their real motive was to take away the right of association and the right of political work by the masses. And so basically, they were trying to weaponize the First Amendment against people working together collectively. Having said that, I think what you've seen this year, and you know, the fight against Janus is a part of it, but it's more than that, is that it wasn't just Trump voters who were shaken up in the run up to the 16 election and in the 16 election. I think you see the country has been shaken up, and definitely, that there's been an activist bent that has not just responded. Resistance is a piece of it. Persistence is a piece of it, but it is banding together to fight for a better way. And that's what we're seeing around the country. And again, it goes back to the two lessons that I've learned. It goes back to your question, you know, many, many minutes ago about the difference between New York and the rest of the country, in that New York, the fights, they were fierce and tough fights, but the value proposition was basically similar. People believed that people should live together in harmony, and believed that government had a role to help people have a better life. What's happened now throughout the country is you're seeing more and more of that. And you're seeing this activist zeal. And it's not just in New York or in San Francisco or in LA. Take the women's marches. Take the marches against families being separated, or children being separated from their families. Take the marches for the March for Our Lives. Take the science marches. They're all over the place. And they're in places that you would not have expected. So the issue in terms of coffers, that is what the right wing wanted. That is what they're trying to do. They're trying to
get. But it's what they got, right?
Well, they actually have gotten something they didn't expect, which is that people are more motivated to be involved in politics. We have 300 members that are running for office. And ultimately, if members actually stick with their unions as they're doing right now, if people see, as we have talked about for years, that regular working folk have power to change their lives at the bargaining table and at the ballot box, then what's going to happen is that the Janus case would have become the catalyst for actually a new movement of workers within
the
framework.
That's not a little Pollyanna-ish to say, like, actually this court decision that you were fighting for so long is now going to be a good thing?
Don't get me wrong. I don't think that the Janus decision is a good thing. I think taking away people's rights is a bad thing. I think weaponizing the First Amendment so that it's used to try to stymie people's collective voice is a bad thing. However, I'm saying that there's unintended consequence that has happened here, which is that our leaders and members throughout the country have been really engaged in the fight. They know who the bad guys are, and they also are fighting for and talking to people about the value of belonging in a union. So we're seeing in terms of our membership that things are holding because people are talking about values and they're engaged with each other. But we're also seeing huge activism against this kind of cruelty that you see from the Trump administration, faux populism.
Your point earlier was that the labor movement hasn't been communicating as much over the last 20 years because you've had to focus on the existential fights. Well, now with Janus, you've got a real slice in that existential fight, a wound. It won't make that even more the case, that you'll just have to focus on fighting back on Janus and not doing the other things politically, organizationally, that you want labor to be doing?
Well, I think what's happened is that we have all gotten smarter and learned the lessons of Wisconsin, which is that you are not.
You mean the Wisconsin from the Scott Walker?
The Wisconsin from the Scott Walker.
From 2010, exactly. And what happened after that.
So that you don't simply fight back. You fight forward for the things that matter. In my convention speech this year, I talked about my AFT convention speech. Sorry. I talked about a formula, which is member engagement and community involvement over issues that really matter are the pathway to a better life. And that is cathartic. And what's happened is that there have been, we see it in, you know, we are a federation. The AFT is 1.755 million members, but we're a federation of locals. Mm-hmm. And there are about 3,500 locals. And power radiates out up from your locals. That's the heartbeat. And what I think has changed is a few things. People get that the union is not a transaction. That if they want to have the power to better our lives, that the union is a family. It's an organism. And so it has to be tended to and supported and worked on together. And so what you've seen in the last 2 years is that whether it was the teacher strikes in West Virginia, or the work that we're doing for contracts to get to a fair contracts in St. Paul or in Pittsburgh or San Francisco. Member engagement and community involvement over issues that really matter is the way we have been operating. And that's really different than just responding to the attacks. It's naming the attacks, it's fighting the attacks, but it's also fighting for something. And that has been, I think, the difference and catalytic. So I don't mean to be Pollyannish. And if I had it to do over again, we would have hoped that Merrick Garland, that Supreme Court nominee would not have been hijacked and he would have been on the Supreme Court and there would never have been a Janus decision. It would probably never have gotten cert or on and on. But having this is the cards we've been dealt. And we have pierced through the sense that people can go it alone or fend for themselves or that the union is different than they are. And that's been amazingly exciting.
Richard Trumka, who's the head of the AFL-CIO, you're a member, said that he was open to the idea that that the AFL-CIO could back Trump and that others could. You were not impressed by that comment. What do you make of that?
He clarified almost immediately. And one of the reporters who were in the room actually said you could not read from his statements that the AFL-CIO would consider an endorsement of Trump. Look, I think that what Richard is – so first, I would have wished that Richard was unequivocal about this. Like Richard very much. I respect who he is. I respect what he's done in terms of the AFL-CIO. This victory in Missouri is a large part of his vision on this. But this is a which side are you on moment. And as a granddaughter of refugees from the Ukraine and from Russia, I think you can fight for border security and fight for a country that does not cage children who are separated from their families. We are better than that. And there are certain things that are disqualifying.
That's an issue that's not a union issue, though. So right.
It's a union issue. In my union, it's a union issue. Mm-hmm. And frankly, in the AFL-CIO, fighting to ensure that people are treated as people better be a union issue. The problem we have sometimes in this country is that issues about the value of human life, human dignity, That's what we fight for as unionists all the time. So what is the difference between the value of human life when it is a boss that is treating you terribly, or when it is a government that is treating you terribly? Why would a union be involved in politics if you didn't see that fighting for a government that treats people humanly is a union issue? But, you know, I think what Richard was focused on, and, you know, we've seen this a lot, is that Trump is very much trying to divide the traditional manufacturing unions that he believes are still significantly white and male from everyone else.
People who were affected by trade, theoretically, right. and his calculation of it, right?
Right. But frankly, everybody's affected. I mean, we were very engaged in the NAFTA fight. We were very engaged in the fight on the Pacific trade deals, because everybody's affected by this. When you live in Ohio, in Lordstown, and the Lordstown plant, the auto plant closes down, that affects everyone in the community. And so for the same reasons as our folks fought to keep the aluminum plant open, the Alcoa plant open in Messina, New York, teachers and steel workers together, we fight to keep things made in America. But I think what happened is that, everyone thinks there is a sense that if you're nice to Trump and you sweet talk Trump, you can get things done. And, you know, I think that was really I think that we very much, as a labor movement, want to have fair trade, not free trade. We want to make sure that things get made in America again, because that will lead to, we hope, good jobs, good paying jobs, and that people can, feed their families on. And I think that he was, trying to send Trump a message that the AFL-CIO would engage in the trade issues. At the same time, let me say very clearly, I think Trump has been, from my union's perspective, from what I just saw at our convention, I think that Trump has been disqualified by his conduct towards people, towards public education, towards labor, towards what he said in the Janus decision. I think he is disqualified from a trade union endorsement.
And from any union backing him, you think, unequivocally?
Well, I'm just talking about my union.
What about any Republicans? Can you see the unions backing Republicans?
Look,
at this
I think
point?
If Republicans take the positions, again, this goes back to values as opposed to personalities. I don't think we should be, I may be a Democrat, but I voted for Republicans in the past.
Which Republicans have you voted for?
I voted for Jacob Javits.
Okay.
My first elections. I have
so you voted for the quintessential liberal New York Republican.
That
would have been 1980 or so.
I voted for Ben Gilman when he was my congressman.
Okay.
From growing up in Rockland County.
Also not a.
But this is my point. My point is the Republican Party has changed.
It has.
I voted for our union endorsed George Pataki. At one point or another. I mean, so what I'm saying is that, and by the way, for everybody who's listening to the podcast, whoever you vote for, vote. but this is also how the Republican Party has changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was alive when Abraham Lincoln was president, I would have voted for Abraham
sure.
Lincoln.
Is there a Republican now running, not Ben Gilman, not George Pataki, not Jacob Javits, that you could see yourself supporting, that you could see the AFT supporting?
We have Republicans right now that AFT locals are supporting. And yes, there are Republicans who I could see supporting. There are Democrats that I could see supporting. There are independents that I could see supporting. The issue is not the party label. The issue is what they stand for and what they will do, either as governor, as local school board, as city council, as House member, as Senate member.
One of the things that we hear a lot about...
Will they work for people or not? Will they work for corporations or will they work for people?
But you see anybody who is associated with Trump as making a decision in itself.
Well, I see that Trump has... I see that what Trump has done in terms of cheering on the Janus decision, fighting for a tax cut that 84% of whose benefits have gone to the most wealthy, and creating huge deficits that now make it harder to do big infrastructure projects, to fix crumbling roads and bridges, to do investments in education, to address issues like student debt, to address the huge costs of drugs. Having a vibrant economy where people build in America is really important. But the way in which Trump has operated has been to exacerbate, is to pit people against each other and to basically work for those who are already well endowed in the United States. Inequality has increased. Wages have continued to stagnate. I'm glad that the economic growth that we've seen starting in the Obama presidency have continued, but regular working people haven't seen it. But the other piece that Trump has done is that he lies, he violates the norms of democracy, and democracy is absolutely essential in order for regular folks to have a decent shot at life.
I just feel like I was not at the session that Trumka did a couple of weeks ago when he made the comment about Trump, but I remember being at one in the early 2012 when he held out the possibility that maybe the AFL-CIO wouldn't back Hillary Clinton, in 2016. And it just feels like unions sometimes play this game where like, oh, we're open to endorsing whoever, but like every time it's with the Democrats.
But I think that the issue is that the Republican Party has fundamentally changed.
Yeah. One thing that comes up in conversation a lot, I've found, is that people in Washington will talk about how all of the tweets and all of the palace intrigue that goes on at the White House distracts from things that the administration is doing in a real way. Policies that we don't think about that don't get as much attention. You pay more attention to the Labor Department and the Education Department than most people do. What are things that are going on that you think people should be paying more attention to that just haven't gotten attention?
So basically, Betsy DeVos is dismantling the entire civil rights commitment in the Education Department that has been there since Lyndon Johnson. So she's in the midst of dismantling all that. And the second thing...
What does that mean?
What it means is that if I am a kid in Texas and I think that something has happened to me that, has been terrible, that I'm not getting a decent education and somebody right next door who happens to be of a different color is, I used to be able to go to the Education Department and say, wait a second, something's wrong here. That if you see, for example, that there's five times the number of kids being suspended who are black and brown than white, then that is a civil rights issue that America has to focus on. If you see that a special needs kid is not getting the services she needs, but kids in general education are, that's a right that the federal government used to redress as part of the war on poverty, as part of that second bit of the second generation of trying to create equity as part of the civil rights battles of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. All of that is getting dismantled in some ways. And the second thing that's getting dismantled is all of the work that was done to try to stop kids, college kids, from being fleeced or hosed or hurt by predatory lenders or by for-profit colleges. Basically, there's a sign on the, you know, as Betsy DeVos has actually locked out school teachers who want to give her comments about what's going on in schools. She has a big virtual sign in the education department saying, "Profiteers, you are welcome." And so, that's a virtual sign.
Right.
I don't think it's up there yet.
Have you met with her?
Look, I did. She actually sent me a note saying congratulations on my wedding. But we met, when she was confirmed, she called me and I said, come to a school with us. And she said, I'll do that if you come with me. I said, fine. And so she came with us for a day to Van Wert, Ohio. It was three of the 18 public schools that she had seen in 2017. And, you know, she made a lot of promises to a lot of people who were there. She saw a lot of things, but hasn't fulfilled any one of them. And that was a district, again, who loves public education. People love public education. They see it as foundational for their kids' success. But they voted overwhelmingly for Trump. But since that point, I tried to actually go to a school she wanted me to go to. But it, you know, the two times that so the scheduling didn't work out. And since that point, aside from getting a note saying congratulations on your gay wedding, I haven't heard from her since.
Did she say congratulations on your gay wedding?
No, she said congratulations on your wedding. I got a chuckle out of it, given that.
As the head of the teachers union, you had one school visit with her and one note since, and your wedding was in March, right? And that's it.
That's it. And frankly, we had said that we were willing to meet with her. We were willing to engage with her. Even though we completely disagree on issues.
And a lot of Democrats are running campaigns that feature her quite prominently. Do you think that that's a good idea? Is that the way that this should be?
Well, I think that, again, it's a which side are you on moment. And if the president, just like with Jeff Sessions, who did the zero tolerance policies that led to the caging of children on the border, just like Pruitt, who is dismantling the environmental standards that have kept our, you know, air clean and our water safe to drink. What Betsy DeVos represents is the values of the Trump administration.
But her name ID is through the roof. It's kind of amazing when you see it, right? I mean, for an education secretary, nobody ever knows who the education secretary is.
I think what happens is that even more, you know, if you look in the past at people that the Bushes appointed or that Reagan appointed, even when they were more focused on privatization or thought that, you know, some of the things that DeVos thinks of, you know, cheered on some of those things, they also actually believed in public education.
Yeah.
They saw public education as foundational to the democracy. They may have had different views, just like, you know, I had very different views than Arne Duncan about how to improve schools.
But Obama's education secretary for most
correct.
Of the time.
But they actually understood that public education served 90% of the children in America and that their job as the education secretary was to do something that tended to it, supported it, improved it, strengthened it. Betsy DeVos is the first education secretary that does not believe in it. And frankly, doesn't believe even in accountability for charters or accountability for vouchers. So the civil rights process of having alternatives that could actually, in the public sphere, that could actually help kids succeed, she doesn't believe in that either. She basically believes in taking public money and giving it to her friends, and she calls it, you know, choice. I mean, look at ECOT, the school in Ohio. This was a school that was basically a virtual charter school. It stole money from Ohio. Just today or yesterday, there was yet another court decision talking about the fraud of its of its directors and its owners. That's the kind of school, that virtual school, K-12 Inc. Betsy DeVos was on their boards. So she, her basic view is destabilize, defund public education. I watched it up close and personal in Detroit, where we came within inches of losing a public school system for the kids of Detroit. She was on the other side of that battle. And now, because she lost that battle, although, you know, the schools
in Detroit are terrible, though.
The schools in Detroit are getting better. Yes, they were they were not great, but the schools are
Mayor Duggan, the Detroit mayor, was did the podcast a year ago, and part of what he talked about was just how bad the schools
are. Yeah, but Mayor Duggan and we are working together to improve them. The difference is, you need to be honest and have an honest assessment about what, you know, where schools are, and then you have to have a journey to improve them. Then you have to have a roadway to improve them.
All right, last question here. We talked about coming up through New York. Did you ever encounter Donald Trump along the way there?
Yes.
In what circumstances?
Look, you know, at different, I mean, I've often said that I never I was at, you know, I was at lots of things when I was in New York, and I never encountered him at anything educational, like never at any of the educational things I was at. But, you know, through civic things, I encountered him. And it doesn't surprise me that he acts the way he acts, because this is exactly how he acted in New York as well.
He acted, you feel like, the same. People see it as a continuum, and some people see it as something that spiked, moved him in a different direction.
Donald Trump has always been about Donald Trump. And Donald Trump will say and do anything that will help Donald Trump. He is an amazing salesperson. He can sell lots of, you know, he was an amazing salesperson in New York. You saw Trump name up on everything, or on virtually everything. But, you know, he is an amazing salesperson.
Is there any encounter that sticks out along the way?
It's just that I never had a personal conversation with him. I always traveled, you know, I spent a lot of time with a lot of the real estate guys in New York, but he was never engaged in any of the real civic work. You know, if he could make a buck, you saw him there.
If he invited you over to the White House right now, would you go?
Of course. And in fact, I asked for a meeting, because at the end of the day, this is about fighting for ensuring that people have a better life. And so, of course, you will meet with whoever you need to meet with to do that. You have to show up. We care, we fight, we show up, we vote. But that doesn't mean that you agree. This is really a whose side are you on moment. So we asked for a meeting when Betsy DeVos put a budget in that cut every single summer school program and every single after school program and cut all the class size programs and all the programs for professional development. I asked him for a meeting at that point. Of course, he ignored it. I also asked him for a meeting to give our views about what was happening in the aftermath of Parkland, since, you know, our members actually both in Parkland and in Newtown were killed in these tragedies. Kids were killed. Kids under our watch were killed in these tragedies. And we have a lot of expertise about what we thought and what we think should be done. Never been asked our opinion.
All right. Well, you got to say what you wanted here, I guess. Randy Weingarten, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So, does she sound Pollyannish to you? Do you think what she's saying is part of the solution or part of the problem with what's ahead for American politics and government? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. And make sure you've subscribed and told everyone you know to subscribe. And rate us, too. There's an algorithm in there that helps get Off Message out to more and more people, the more and better those ratings are. I suggest 5 stars, of course. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter @IsaacDobert. Catch you next time on Off Message.